The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back. Wednesday, March 20th, 2019. This is the Seth Leibson Show. I am Seth. 602-508-0960 is the number. We have a big show for you today. I want to continue our discussion on education. I want to get into the Trump feud with the recently deceased John McCain. An interesting column in the Arizona Republic on that from the editorial director of the Arizona Republic, editorial page editor. Kind of not what you expect, probably. We'll get into all of that, as well as promised a discussion on the Electoral College and other schemes, national and state, to change our election system, mostly coming from the Democrats, with maybe the world's expert on the Electoral College, Professor Michael Yulman from Claremont. He almost single-handedly saved it in the 1970s. When it was up on the chopping block from the Democrats then, and he is, as I say, probably the most published person in the country, if not the world, on the importance of the Electoral College. So we'll talk to him, as well as the great Heather MacDonald, on scandals in higher education. Also want to talk about this, I think, very harebrained scheme from Kristen Gillibrand and Cory Booker and others on their efforts to address the opioid crisis. I think it is, I'll get into that in a little bit with you, too. I think it's harebrained, and I think it will do absolutely zero to help in the drug overdose and abuse crisis that we now face ourselves. But starting with education and continuing with that, if I may, I was spending the evening looking at various speeches and essays on the purposes of education. I really liked a speech that Dr. Bennett did for Hillsdale on the purpose of education and the purpose of liberty. He asked the question, what kind of character do our kids have? Who's paying attention to their morals? A judge in Detroit once said to me, when I ask young men today, didn't anyone ever teach you the difference between right and wrong? They answer, no, sir. And I believe them. There is a moral vacuum out there. I can remember teachers in the public school asking, can you help us develop some materials that we can use with our kids to teach them right from wrong? Isn't that ironic? The public schools of this country, which were established principally to provide common moral instruction for a nation of immigrants, we're now wondering if it was possible to do so. Many people expressed the concern that we had become so enamored of our economic and material success that we were neglecting more important things. Someone wrote a letter and said, if we have streets of gold and silver, but our children do not learn to walk with God, what will we have gained? Some of us, frankly, had our doubts about whether this moral dilemma could be solved. We had that problem as we were watching not only higher dropout rates, greater rates of drug addiction, illegitimacy, divorce, declining SAT scores, rising and rising crime. How do you teach against all that? How do you teach against all that? I think the answer regarding how to teach against all that is pretty straightforward. Aristotle had a good read on it, and modern psychology and other contemporary studies backed him up. We teach by habit, we teach by precept, and we teach by example. Aristotle says that habituation at an early age makes more than a little difference. It makes almost all the difference. So if you want kids to learn what work is, you should have them work. If you want them to learn what responsibility means, you should hold them responsible. If you want them to learn what perseverance is, you should encourage them to persevere, and you should start as early as possible. Of course, this is harder to do than to say. Being a parent and teaching these things is rigorous work. Precepts are also important. The Ten Commandments, the principles of American democracy, rules of courteous behavior. These and other lists of right and wrongs should be provided to young people. But as we provide them, young people need to know that we take the precepts seriously too. And that leads to the third part of teaching virtue that Aristotle talked about, which is example. And that probably is the one we should emphasize the most. I don't believe particularly in courses on values. I don't think that's the way to go about solving the problem. If we want young people to take right and wrong seriously, there is an indispensable condition. They must be in the presence of adults who take right and wrong seriously. Only in this way will they see that virtue is not just a game, not just a talk, but rather that it is something grown-up people, people who have responsibilities in the world and at home, take seriously. Let me give you an extreme example of the futility of precept in the absence of example. More than once, I've been in schools where they are teaching or hosting a virtue of the week. In one such school, the virtue of the week was honesty. There had been a test on honesty, and the teacher told me that she had to prepare a second test because she had caught so many students cheating on the first. We are missing the point of the enterprise here. Our children won't take honesty seriously until we grown-ups demand honesty of ourselves and of others, including of our leaders. Lessons of 9/11. There are many lessons to be drawn, and they are teachable events. And it is interesting to me how far away we are moving in time from those events and how many lessons from them we are losing. Did you see the news the other day that John Walker Lind will be released this year because his 20-year sentence is up? Do you remember that name? John Walker Lind, also known as the American Taliban, one of the first people captured in Afghanistan, turned out to have been an American fighting with the Taliban, joining with the Taliban. He was sentenced to 20 years. Who knew he would see the light of day? Guess what? Time's up. And guess what? He's a supporter of ISIS. Guess what? We're going to be releasing him. All right, let's talk about it. September 11th. There are a lot of teachable events there, and it can be used as a teachable event. I was with a family the other day showing their children documentaries, and it struck me how odd it was that these children had no knowledge of something that was so monumental, and in my mind, so recent. Many sophisticated or pseudo-sophisticated people have been nursing the idea for years that concepts like right and wrong and good and evil are outmoded. 9/11 was a really good teachable moment in the opposite direction. We saw the face of evil and felt the hand of evil. At the same time, we saw the face of good and felt the many hands of good. And the kids who were watching it at the time felt and saw these things too. We also saw the sinew, the fiber, the character of the American people. I'm not just talking about the firefighters and cops, talking about people associated with places like Xavier High School, who died trying to rescue and help people, talking about those men on American Flight 93, the American businessmen traveling across the country with nothing greater of a weapon than their laptop. These are the guys who are the butt of humor for every aspiring intellectual and every Hollywood filmmaker who wants to run down America. Life in the suburbs, according to these so-called elites, is full of emptiness and desolation and misery. And perhaps I'm overstating this, but the middle-class American businessman has been the target of an awful lot of criticism from an awful lot of directions for an awful lot of years. When the chips were down, though, they did pretty well, didn't they? I was reading an updated transcript a couple weeks ago in which one of the four men who rushed the cockpit on Flight 93 said to the person on the other end of the phone line, "We're waiting until we get over a rural area." They knew what was likely to happen, so they were waiting in order to minimize the death toll they knew they would be responsible. What extraordinary human beings those Americans turned out to be. Lot to learn from 9/11. A lot. And it illustrates some of the most important themes, the importance of the things we can't see, of non-material things. Moral examples can exist in the memory of a father, or in the memory of founding fathers, or in the memory of any of the marvelous heroes in the long history of humankind. You think about someone like Todd Beamer as a hero, and you think about what his children will learn from him. Years and years and years of growing up without him, knowing only the story of what he did for this country on 9/11. The historian Tacitus wrote, "The task of history is to hold out for reprobation every evil word and deed, and to hold out for praise every great and noble word and deed." So we don't really need courses in values. We need good courses in history. We need to revive the reading of good books. We need to provide good precepts and encourage good habits. Above all, we have to teach by example. It's not to say that we need to be perfect to be good examples. Our children can see us try and fail from time to time, but then they can see us try and do better or get it right the second time. Thus they learn about human limitations, but also about human perseverance and ability. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. This story of ongoing issues between Donald Trump and things he is saying about John McCain will not die down. It was the lead story on Fox News at the top of the hour. And I suppose it could afford to take less less interest in the media and perhaps less interest from Donald Trump as well, but so too from Meghan McCain. Phil Boas has an interesting column in the Arizona Republic. He's the editor of the editorial page at the Arizona Republic, and he is saying something here about John McCain we have been saying for a long time about not only not only George H.W. Bush, not only Ronald Reagan, but even George W. Bush, which is the further from power they are, and once they are dead, the media seems to hold these Republicans up in ways they never used to. As Boas puts it, switch it from thumbs down to thumbs up and everything changes. Thumbs up and Donald Trump isn't, as Boas puts it, spitting on the grave of John McCain. Thumbs up and the earnest media isn't defending McCain's honor. History turned on an axis in the early hours of July 28, 2017, when McCain approached the Senate clerk and voted against his party, a thumbs down to Obamacare repeal. You remember the drama of it, too, with John holding his hand out, Senator McCain holding his hand out for seconds so it could get the maximum amount of coverage and drama. Had it gone the other way, Boas writes, Donald Trump would be working on repairing McCain's image, because if McCain had voted to repeal Obamacare, the left would have savaged him 2 years ago and framed the McCain legacy in the worst possible light. How do I know? Because liberals had started to waste John McCain, not when he was deceased, but when he was merely cancer-stricken and facing the prospect of imminent death. You think McCain didn't know who they were? He did. The Democrats and their media mouthpieces revealed themselves explicitly in the days before thumbs down, when they misread a couple of procedural votes and believed McCain would repeal Obamacare. That John McCain wasn't a war hero and a maverick. He was a warmonger and fat cat who cared nothing for the poor. He had his solid gold health plan, after all. The poor could take an aspirin. Here's how the New York Times wrote it from the pen of Paul Krugman. Quote, "Can we take a moment to consider the awfulness of John McCain? Close quote. That was 2017. He went on, "In case you haven't been following the story, what has been going on in the Senate these past few days is one of the most shameful episodes in that body's history," he wrote about John McCain. James Fallows wrote in The Atlantic that McCain would be remembered for, quote, "steering American politics down the path that led to Donald Trump by choosing Sarah Palin as his running mate," close quote. Los Angeles Times editorialized, quote, "It's hard to ignore the irony of Senator John McCain returning to Washington from cranial surgery at the Mayo Clinic just to keep alive a bill that would make health insurance unaffordable to millions of Americans," close quote. Adam H. Johnson of the hyper-left Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting used an op-ed in the LA Times to remind readers in the middle of the healthcare debate that McCain is, quote, a reliable partisan conservative who loves war, has never met a war he didn't like, advocated for an Iraq invasion that caused 500,000 to 1 million deaths, and selectively cares about human rights when it permits him to lay the groundwork for U.S. aggression. Close quote. That was the L.A. Times. A day later, McCain voted their way to preserve Obamacare. As the American woman of letters, that great American woman of letters, Emily Letella, once observed, well, that's very different, isn't it? Now, never mind. But now the left champions John McCain, don't they? Anna Navarro, a formerly closeted liberal who used to masquerade as a Republican, said, quote, I don't care if you like John McCain or couldn't stand him. Attacking a dead national hero is what Trump is doing, and that's disgusting, abominable, inhumane, indecent, immoral, and everybody should condemn it. Has anyone noticed, Boas asks, that the president is a blowhard? Who cares what Donald Trump says about John McCain? It means nothing. It means absolutely nothing. That's the point Boas is trying to make, and that's what he says. The media that is lionizing and honoring John McCain, their memories need to be reduced, need to be restored, and they need to ask themselves, I think, some very serious questions here about how they lionize different Republicans when they're not in power, when they're not a threat, when they're not running for office anymore. What the press has said about John McCain over the past 2 years is a lot different than what they said about him for 20 and 30 and 40 years. Why is that? Was it because he was a hero? No, he was a hero for the past lifetime. No, it had nothing to do with that. It had to do with his politics. They're the ones who are being partisan here. They're the ones. And if you think Obamacare is the sacred cow that keeps this country from falling over the cliff of misery and worse health care for Americans, it isn't. More people are unhappy with their health care now than before Obamacare. More people have a harder time with health care now than before Obamacare. More people have fewer choices in health care and higher expenses with health care premiums now than they did with Obamacare. And one thing I don't think Phil Boas does right in his op-ed, if he does, I apologize. But do remember, too, that John McCain campaigned for re-election hard on saying he will lead the fight to repeal Obamacare. What does that say about a politician? What does that say about a political leader? What does that say about this great man of character the press has now discovered as the last great Republican to walk the face of the United States of America? I think Donald Trump can drop it. I think his point has been made. Should merely say, thank you for your service, sir, and move on. But the media here, too, needs to ask a few questions. Which John McCain is it that they're supporting and like? Which John McCain is it that they want to defend? And why? Was it because of his status as a war hero? Because it didn't matter when his politics were conservative, and it didn't matter when he was running against Barack Obama. It only mattered to them once he started challenging Donald Trump. And quite frankly, let's not forget what started this whole thing up. The revelation of John McCain putting the Steele dossier in the hands of the FBI while a John McCain senior aide was prancing it all around, in his own words, through Washington, D.C. to get as much attention on it as possible. The dossier that turned out to be nothing more than fake stories about Donald Trump that has led to an investigation by Robert Mueller that will turn out to be zero. Zero. John McCain and his aides' hands aren't clean here either. And that's what started Donald Trump's criticism of John McCain. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I am Seth Leibson. If it is 3:34, it is time to do our culture and economy check-in with John Dombrowski Jr. from Grand Canyon Planning Associates, his website, grandcanyonplanning.com. Happy Wednesday, John. Hope you're well.
I'm doing great. Thanks, Seth. How about you?
I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. Looks like this country is going to have a debate given a lot of different stories about education and some new proposals from the Trump administration about student loans, not only the crisis we have with student loans, the worthy of the investment in them, and, of course, the reckoning with the $1.5 trillion in outstanding student loan debt.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on this? And then I want to ask you a question about what you advise people about taking out these loans or investing in private school tuition for the payoff in latter years.
Great topic, Seth. I know we've talked about this a number of times. And one of the interesting sides of this is, do I think that this is a real challenge for people going to college today, you know, the younger generation that's getting started trying to get an education? I absolutely do. This is a real challenge for them. And I believe there's a lot of unscrupulous, people out there that are pushing these loans, even though the interest rates may be reasonable, but the amount, the unlimited amount of loans that you can get. In other words, there's no cap on what you can borrow for your education. And this is what they're addressing in an article here recently about the Trump administration proposing borrowing limits mm-hmm. for some student loans.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could get to a point, obviously, Seth, as you know, that you've got too much debt. You're never going to climb out of that. No matter what you're doing, you'll be paying this for the rest of your life. And this is just something that would be a drag on individuals for such a long period of time. And oftentimes they default on these loans. And these are not loans that you can get out of because they're government loans.
One of the proposals is having the colleges be co-signers or sharing responsibility, which you alluded to.
I saw that.
I very much like this idea because I think it'll bring certain accountability to these universities that seem to really need it in the wake mm-hmm. of last week's news and in the wake of mm-hmm. a lot of other things that are coming to light, having to do with accountability. Maybe they won't keep students who don't deserve and can't make the grade, as it used to be said. Maybe they will start curbing 5 and 6 year undergraduate plans. Maybe they will start being a little bit more responsible with tuition hikes, which seem to increase every time we seem to make more available, more student loans, interestingly
mm-hmm.
enough.
Yeah, and it's what's interesting about that, Seth, is if you go back to the year 2000, in this state of Arizona, we had the alternative fuel tax credit. Do you remember that?
Yes.
So you could buy a alternative fuel vehicle if it qualified and get an incredible amount of tax credit. And it was so interesting. This goes exactly to this point that you just made. You were able to buy an electric golf cart at the time, and the state would give you a $10,000 tax credit, and there was a $1,000 federal tax credit. Guess how much the cost of the vehicle was? You can guess, can't you?
Yeah.
$11,000.
Funny.
How did that happen?
Yeah, funny that.
Right?
Yeah.
It wasn't worth $11,000, but because it was tax credits, people would pay it because they, in reality, they weren't paying it. It was something that was getting refunded through a tax credit from the state and the federal government. So same thing here. If we make the colleges a little bit more vested in this, mm-hmm. financially invested in this, there's going to probably be some differences as to how they'll look at this, and they're going to try to qualify these individuals to see if, they're going to really try to help them so that they can make these payments. But, Seth, as a financial advisor, my job is to help folks, put money aside for these types of things.
Sure.
So for grandparents out there, for parents right now, if you've got a new person,
a new
part
child
of your
or
family.
Grandchild. Yeah, right.
Yeah, you got a baby that was just born into the family. Hey, what would be a great gift for them is to start an educational fund for them now. And think about over the next 15, 20 years, that money's going to grow tax-free if you use the correct vehicle. And you could really make a tremendous impact on that child's life as far as education goes if you could make that contribution today. And if they don't use it, well, guess what, folks? You get to take that money back. There are plans out there that are designed specifically for this, and there's some great tax advantages for both you as the donor and for the recipient. So I encourage folks to really take this seriously and to invest in your child's future by investing in some type of a college savings program for them.
Really nicely done, John.
Yep. All right, securities and advisory services offered through Client One Securities LLC, a member of FINRA and SIPC, and an investment advisor. Grand Canyon Planning Associates LLC and Client One Securities LLC are not affiliated. Talk to your investment advisor or talk to me about this program. They're out there and they're available.
Thanks, John. We'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
I'm Seth Leibson, 602-508-0960. Thomas, don't go away. I'm coming to you. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I am Seth, 602-508-0960. Thomas is in Santan Valley. Hi, Thomas. Are you there, sir? Thomas, can you hear me? Yes? No? Going once? Going
Hello?
Hi, there you are.
Sorry, I heard a beep and then...
Oh, that's all right.
So.
No worries. We're good. I hear you now.
Unless I'm missing something, last time I checked, John Walker Lind was convicted in 2002.
Right.
Sentenced to 20 years without parole.
With a possibility of early release.
There was a possibility.
There was, as I understand it, there was a possibility of early release, yes.
Yeah, I saw my notes show that it was sentenced to 20 years without possibility of parole.
He's getting out in May. Well, there wouldn't have been a parole situation, but it was a possibility of an early release.
Okay.
And,
so he is getting out early.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's my understanding. So he'll have served, what, 17 years, it looks like?
About that, yeah.
Yeah, seems like yesterday to me, doesn't it? Seems like yesterday to me.
It does seem like yesterday that they finally caught him.
I think he should be ineligible for any release. I think the government should have agreed to his guilty plea, which is how he got the 20-year sentence in the first place. They had him on several counts, which would have kept him in jail for life. I still don't understand why they didn't indict him for treason, but that was for whatever reason never on the books. But they did have enough counts against him to keep him in jail in prison for life. But I guess in those early days after 9/11, the government was still trying to wrestle with and understand, you know, how they were going to prosecute these kinds of cases, and they accepted his guilty plea to this deal that gave him 20 years. I just wish they didn't. In retrospect,
they never should have made the deal.
No, they
never
should have.
And on top of it, because he's
never renounced his support of the Taliban. He's never renounced his support of that. You know, this guy knew Osama bin Laden. He met Osama bin Laden. He may very well and likely is. In part responsible for the first death in Afghanistan of an American, which was Mike Spann, a CIA officer who was killed in a prison uprising, which John Walker Lind probably knew about and could have told Spann about because Spann
exactly.
had interviewed him earlier in the day. Spann's dad to this day still blames John Walker Lind for his son's death.
Well, like you said, chances are Lynn knew about it, or
yeah.
he could have been involved in starting it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was part of the original list of indictments, too. This whole thing just turns the stomach. It just turns the stomach. The farther we move away from 9/11, the worse everything we've done about it of late seems to get. It just really is. It's horrible. It's just horrible.
Well, and with him saying that he supports ISIS.
Yeah.
If he gets out, I want him under surveillance 24/7.
Well, see, there's another problem. He applied. I don't know how you can do this, but while in prison, he applied for Irish citizenship. Go figure. And Ireland granted it to him. Go figure. So, I mean, he's going to go to Ireland, and gosh knows what will happen.
He's going to go to Ireland, and he's going to find a way
like.
To get to the Middle East.
Yeah, maybe. Quite maybe. Or back to Afghanistan. Yeah. Yeah.
The Irish government has one of the most sought-after passports out there. It's basically a free-reign passport. He can go wherever he wants.
There you
and
go. There
they
you
basically,
go.
They basically, quote-unquote, stay neutral in this idea. So, that's how he gets the freaking citizenship.
It absolutely turns the stomach. Absolutely turns the stomach. And his parents, I hated the way his parents talked about him. They said he was a patsy. They defended him, you know, throughout. John Walker Lind was, as I say, himself and to this day, you know, not at all remorseful. Everything about this just stinks to high heavens. Stinks to high
yes.
heavens.
He should never be let out. I'm sorry, Seth, but he really shouldn't.
You're
if
with
me. Let him
you
out,
and I are in fierce agreement, Thomas. Fierce agreement.
He should be kept under surveillance the entire time.
Some days I realize I wish I just had a better thesaurus or a bigger thesaurus or a deeper thesaurus because the words fail me. Words absolutely fail me. You know, the irony of the situation where he's joined the Taliban, Michael Spann, who is with the CIA, dies. The idea that Spann's family has to be, you know, in grieving the rest of their life. While, you know, the Lind family gets to celebrate that their son can join the Taliban, work for al-Qaeda, know bin Laden, and spend 17 years courtesy of Uncle Sam only to move to Ireland, you know, without having to, you know, renounce any of his retrograde beliefs. All of it just stinks.
He should have been forced to renounce it all at the time of his trial, and he never should have been given that deal. We never should have made that deal with
him. Never. Never.
Let him spend the rest of his life in prison. I don't care. He turned traitor against his country.
You bet. You bet. You bet. Thank you, Thomas. I'm sorry to report bad news, but that's the news. Let me ask you another question while we're thinking about things that, you know, maybe a lot of Americans weren't in tune with. Do you realize that China has basically 1 million is holding 1 million Muslims, 1 million Muslims in custody? Here's a story and destroying their city. About this, Ilhan Omar has nothing to say, by the way. About her co-religionists in China, she has nothing to say. Here's the Wall Street Journal today. Dateline Urumqi, China. I hope I'm saying it right. Sorry if I'm not. In this old Silk Road city in western China, a state security campaign involving the detention of vast numbers of people, 1 million, has moved to its next stage, demolishing their neighborhoods and purging their culture. 2 years after authorities began rounding up Urumqi's mostly Muslim ethnic Uyghur residents, many of the anchors of Uyghur life and identity are being uprooted. Empty mosques remain, while the shantytown homes that surrounded them have been replaced by glass towers and retail strips like many found across China. Food stalls that sold fresh naan, the circular flatbread that is to Uyghur society what baguettes are to the French, gone. The young men that once baked the naan have disappeared, as have many of their customers. Uyghur language books are missing from store shelves in a city the capital of China's Xinjiang region that has long been a center of the global Uyghur community. Supplanting the Turkic culture that long defined large parts of the Urumqi is a sanitized version catering to Chinese tourists. On a recent morning in the Erduako neighborhood, the once bustling heart of Uyghur Urumqi, naan ovens were nowhere to be seen. But souvenir shops sold naan-shaped pocket mirrors, naan bottle openers, and circular throw pillows with covers printed to look like them. The transformation is the leading edge of a campaign by China's ruling Communist Party to forcibly assimilate the Uyghurs. Beijing says the detentions combat terrorism, and the demolition, along with billions of dollars in investment in the region, is bringing development. This is ethnic cleansing. This is ethnic cleansing. It would be nice. It would be nice if the UN could denounce that. They won't. It would be nice if Ilhan Omar might say something about her co-religionists being immiserated in China, being wiped out in China, being arrested and detained merely because of their religion in China. She won't. To her shame, to China's shame, to the UN's shame. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Coming up, the great Heather MacDonald of the City Journal and Manhattan Institute. She can talk with us about all kinds of things going on in higher education today, including the scandal that was unmasked last week having to do with college admissions. A story out of Harvard. It's really quite amazing. It's a Harvard law professor who's on the defense team of Harvey Weinstein. I get that Harvey Weinstein's about the least of the people you would want anyone defending, but he is entitled to a legal defense, and it's too much for many Harvard students. So they're seeking and demanding the firing of this professor at Harvard Law because of the client he represents. I'll tell you something. If he were representing a death row inmate, they would not be rising up against him. They would not. Then, of course, there's a case over at Sarah Lawrence College where a conservative tenured professor had a column in the New York Times claiming the administration at Sarah Lawrence was even more liberal than the faculty. The students there, for the examples he cited, are trying to have a tenure review meeting over this professor so that he, too, can be fired. When there isn't scandal and corruption in the admissions systems of these colleges, it appears as if the adults, back to my first opening statement and monologue about education generally, it appears that the students seem to think they're in charge, and that the senior faculty and the senior administration officials at these colleges have allowed these students to be in charge. As Heather writes in a recent article, if higher education had not itself become a corrupt institution featuring low classroom demands, no core knowledge acquisition, low grading standards, fashionable left-wing activism, luxury hotel amenities, endless partying, and huge expense, few of these scandals would be going on. But that's what colleges have become. Students often learn virtually nothing during their college years. They may even lose that pittance of knowledge with which they entered college. Seniors, whether they're at Princeton, Yale, Cornell, Duke, and Berkeley, actually scored lower in a rather undemanding test of American history than they did as freshmen, according to a 2000 study commissioned by the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. College, she writes, is only desultorily about knowledge acquisition, at least outside of the STEM fields. Heather McDonald coming up. Electoral college at the bottom of the hour with the world's expert on it. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.